Hello, it's John Dennis on Friday the 6th of February. Today, David Miliband defends his decision to keep evidence of alleged torture of a British man held at Guantanamo Bay a secret. He cites our old friend, national security.
Mr. Speaker, at the heart of Mr. Mohammed's case have been allegations that he was tortured by foreign government officials in a number of locations. It is the long-standing policy of this government that we never condone, authorise or cooperate in torture.
Also today, the cost of borrowing hits a new record low, just 1%, and the Bank of England may well reduce interest rates even further.
They're in completely uncharted territory. We've never had rates this low before.
And we examine the state of the UK's libraries as the identity of the most borrowed author is revealed.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, today's headlines and the papers with Sandy Waugh.
More than 200 people have had to be rescued from their cars when they were trapped by snow near Exeter. Most were on the A38 and 380 south of Exeter, but dozens of others were brought to a halt on the A386 near Tavistock. They've been taken to shelters near Exeter and Okehampton. Police had to call out the army to help them get through up to a foot of snow. They're now trying to clear the cars. There are many road restrictions, even on the motorway in Devon. The snow has now spread to Northamptonshire and the Midlands. Schools are expected to be closed again through the Midlands and the west of England. Bristol and Luton airports have been closed. There are delays and cancellations on train services through the South, Midlands and the West. The growth of surveillance and the building of state databases is undermining the public's right to privacy, says a parliamentary report today. The House of Lords Constitution Committee says Britain has constructed one of the most extensive surveillance systems in the world, with the growth of CCTV and in building a DNA database. It warns the database could be used for malign purposes and questions whether CCTV actually cuts crime. We'll have the full story later in Guardian Daily. A strike against the use of foreign workers is still going on at an unbuilt power station in Nottinghamshire. While the unofficial action has ended at the oil refinery in Lincolnshire, many of the workers from there have gone to Staythorpe near Newark to join their colleagues who've been demonstrating outside the site for more than 2 weeks. The number of measles cases rose by more than a third in England and Wales last year. There were 1,350 cases in 2008. Researchers are blaming it on the fall in the number of children being given the MMR vaccine amid fears about its safety. As England struggle in the cricket test match in the West Indies, two of their players are doing very well in the players' auction going on in India. England were all out for 318 in the first test in Kingston, and the Windies took their score comfortably to 160 for one. Meanwhile, in the Indian Premier League auction, the top prices of more than £1 million each were paid for Andrew Flintoff and Kevin Peterson. The economy dominates the front pages again this morning. Three cheers, says the Sun. Interest rate cut, house prices up, fat cat bankers facing cap on bonuses. The Express is also more cheerful, saying at last house prices are up. But the Mail and the Telegraph are rather more gloomy. As the Mail puts it, few borrowers benefit and savers now on zero interest. The Financial Times reports Lord Mandelson's warning to the banks that they risked a public outcry if they handed out bonuses perceived as exorbitant. But the Times says there's a stampede by banks to beat the bonus crackdown. It believes Lloyds and Barclays are planning millions of pounds in bonuses before a crackdown. Bad news, the Mirror says up to 16,000 Royal Mail workers may be made redundant in a move to cut costs. Good news, the Independent thinks the government will increase the redundancy payments employers will have to pay staff they lay off. And finally, the Telegraph thinks another government idea to help the car industry could be a £2,000 grant given to people who trade in their old cars for a new one. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
British Guantanamo captive Binyam Mohammed says he was abused in Pakistan, then rendered to Morocco, where he was again tortured, this time with a razor blade applied to his genitals. On Wednesday, the High Court ruled that evidence of this torture must be kept secret. The judges ruled that although it was in the public interest to release the alleged evidence, the Foreign Secretary has the power to suppress it by claiming national security. They said that, according to David Miliband, America had threatened the British with sanctions if the evidence was made public. But yesterday, in a statement to the Commons, the Foreign Secretary denied that a threat had been made.
What the United States said, and it appears in the open public documents of this case, is that disclosure of these documents by order of our courts would be, and I quote, likely to result in serious damage to US national security, and could harm existing intelligence-sharing information between our two governments, unquote. That is a simple affirmation of the facts of intelligence cooperation.
I asked our security editor, Richard Norton Taylor, whether Miliband was telling the truth about what he calls the facts of intelligence cooperation.
They're playing with words, of course. Now, part of the problem is that the judges in their High Court judgment made it quite clear that the Americans had threatened, the word threatened is a word they use 7 or 8 times, that the Americans had threatened the British that they would stop intelligence sharing with Britain, vital to British national interests, as Miliband said, if those documents, or part of those documents, which are in the British government's hands, the Americans gave them to the British government, was released in public. Now, Miliband says there was no question of a threat, instead of which, he says, the Americans made it quite clear that a form of words which basically says that future cooperation on intelligence may be jeopardised. So these words were heavy words, which Miliband and his lawyers gave to the court, and the judge is not surprisingly, in my view, it translated or interpreted that as being a threat. We now know, because the Foreign Office just told me, that they never went to the Obama administration. So that's another, the lawyers for Binyam Mohammed and other people say, that is how Miliband actually, in effect, misled the court, the two judges.
But Miliband would say that there's a wider point based on what he calls the nature of intelligence sharing, which is that if that the intelligence is shared with us on the assumption that it will remain secret. Yeah. So in that sense, yeah, you know, if it becomes made public in the UK, then the Americans will think twice next time they have intelligence to share with us.
That is what the government argue. They say it's a generic system, especially between allies, and they go to try and get applause from, you know, MPs and the Commons and so on, and the public too, I suppose. They say, what happens if we gave intelligence to some other people, and then some foreign court ordered that country to leak British intelligence? Wouldn't that look awful? Well, the fact is, in this case, we're talking about a specific case involving torture, actually, evidence about torture, which the government says it is against in absolute terms. Indeed, the law says the British government cannot indulge or participate in even passively in torture, and that's an absolute condition. Now, the opponents of Miliband says that, and Binyam Mohammed's lawyers say, we're only talking about a little bit of information, a summary of the document, and indeed, the judges themselves, which have seen all the secret stuff, say that the only bit that we, the Guardian, and other people, and Binyam Mohammed's lawyers want public is a summary of those documents, which does not relate at all to sensitive intelligence. And that's what the judges say. So, you know, there's an exception. We're not talking about documents and every word of which will be revealed and names of sources and stuff. We're talking about a summary, or the general gist, as they put it, of what the evidence is that Binyam Mohammed was tortured. And I think, as the judges themselves say, they're not sort of our words, they're not the Guardian's words or, opposition MPs' words, they're the judges' own words, who suggested that these things have been kept secret simply out of political embarrassment. And the words the judges use are very, very strong about how can one country which shares democratic values with another, i.e. US and the UK, can go on like this.
And should David Miliband now press the Americans to release this information?
Well, he was asked that by William Hague, his conservative opposition, the shadow foreign secretary. And he said, no, I'm not in the lobbying game. I'm not going to press the Obama administration on this. And I think, you know, the British, if you're in the Foreign Office or if you're in MI6 or MI5 and you're a kind of advisor to the Foreign Secretary, you're telling the Foreign Secretary, you know, your political master, this is a crucial thing. Please, please stick to your guns. Don't reveal any of this, even though there's going to be a row, even though principles of justice or open justice and all that stuff are at stake. Now, in practice, maybe some of the steam may go out of this because Binyam Mohammed will come back to Britain pretty soon.
Richard Norton Taylor, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/Guantanamo. Also on The Guardian's website today, a special edition of The Guardian's feature section G2, focusing on the recession. Stephen Moss, Stephen Morris and Martin Wainwright speak to people around the country who have lost their jobs, their homes and businesses over the past few months. guardian.co.uk/G2. And you can listen to a recording of the pilot Chesley Sullenberger talking to air traffic control as he made a heroic emergency landing of a passenger jet in the Hudson River. Here's a clip.
210, 4718. I think he said he was going in the Hudson.
You can listen to more of that incredible recording today at guardian.co.uk/audio. The Bank of England cut interest rates by 0.5 percentage point yesterday to 1%. The cost of borrowing hit a new record low just hours after the unexpected news from the Halifax Bank that house prices had risen by 1.9% in January. Yesterday's decision by the bank's Monetary Policy Committee was the first since the UK officially entered recession, and it came after the International Monetary Fund predicted that Britain will be hit harder by the recession than any other advanced nation. Dan Roberts is our head of business. He says some people in the city had hoped for a full percentage point cut.
Yes, I think 0.5% was probably the least was what people expected. But there's always been this sense that the Bank of England has wanted to keep something in reserve. You know, they're in completely uncharted territory. We've never had rates this low before. And I think they feel that if they run out of room for manoeuvre, if they cut everything now, then if the economy looks even worse in 6 months' time, they're going to look completely powerless.
This is the fifth month that the bank has cut interest rates. Can we expect a further cut maybe next month?
Well, it does seem to be heading down to sort of US levels very fast. I mean, they're effectively at zero or close to. And the economists all seem to think that we're heading that way fast as well. Although the interesting question is whether there are some signs out there that maybe previous interest rates cuts are beginning to have some effect.
The bank's Monetary Policy Committee also expressed concern that they might not meet the 2% inflation target. What's the significance of that?
Well, the Bank of England has a sort of a window in which it has to try and match inflation. And if it goes above or below that window, then it has to write to the Chancellor and explain why. And this is the sort of whole purpose of the Bank of England independence, is to sort of give it a target for inflation. And previously it had to write to the bank to explain why it overshot on inflation, and now there's a severe risk that it's going to undershoot because of all the worries that the economy is in such deep downturn that we'll be in deflationary times.
Will lenders pass this rate cut on?
I think every time this happens, we ask ourselves that. And the combination of political pressure on the banks that have received government help, and also just the sheer sort of market desperation to kind of get business through the door, means that the majority of them will to their mortgage customers. What's interesting, actually, is that some of the saving rates have actually not been cut, because I think some banks are realising that if they keep cutting savings rates, actually nobody's going to bother putting any money in savings at all. So paradoxically, the debate this time around is more likely to be whether saving rates will get feel the effect of this rather than mortgage rates being passed on, which was the big political issue the last few times.
What do you make of the news from the Halifax that house prices rose by 1.9% in January?
Well, it's very intriguing. I mean, it's been widely poo-pooed by the economics community today, and indeed Halifax were very sceptical about it. They pointed out that it's very difficult to draw trends from just 1 month, and that all other indicators are pointing to things falling. But I think it has got people wondering when the bottom might come in housing. Clearly, housing was one of the first markets to go into this downturn, and it may well be one of the first markets to come out of it as well, as people sense that there are bargains out there. Whether this is in fact the turning point, we really won't know for a few months. But it's raised that intriguing question. You know, we've been ringing around some estate agents asking what anecdotally is going on in the market. Most of them are saying it's pretty gloomy, but there was one that actually said they'd seen a bit of gazumping coming in. Now, the mere mention of the word gazumping makes you think, well, maybe there is a sort of change, a changing mood in the air. I think it's far, far too early to tell, but it does give us pause for thought.
Dan Roberts. My name's John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, why the credit crisis might be good for Africa as it tries to wean itself off Western aid.
Africa's goal should be to be a part of the global community as an equal partner. This cannot be done without a role for the West and for the emerging countries broadly around the world.
Fundamental freedoms, including the right to privacy, are being put at risk by Britain's surveillance society. That's according to a report published today by a House of Lords committee. It says that the UK's got one of the most extensive and technologically advanced systems of surveillance in the world. Alan Travis, our Home Affairs editor, has the details.
It's quite a heavyweight group of peers, the Lords Constitution Committee, which includes a former Lord Chief Justice, Lord Wolfe, a couple of former Attorney Generals, and it's been looking at the expansion and growth of surveillance and data collection of personal data by the state and by the private sector. And it's come out with quite a swinging, strong verdict, saying that in the name of combating crime and terrorism, British governments have gradually constructed one of the most extensive and technologically advanced surveillance systems in the world. And they say that unbeknownst to most people, completely unaware of the kind of surveillance techniques or data collection that's going on in their lives, the use of these changes means it's what they describe as one of the most significant changes in the life of the nation since the end of the Second World War. So that's fairly, putting it fairly high. As opposed to the achievement of being one of the most extensive and technologically advanced surveillance systems in the world, I suppose you could put it up there somewhere with our achievements at the highest rates of teenage pregnancy in Western Europe. It's one of those, you know, new achievements of the British state that we are having to mark these days.
What do they say about the British state's justification for using this level of surveillance?
Well, they're not very impressed, really. They go through each case in point on CCTV, for example. We now have 4 million cameras, is the usual estimate they cited again. They actually want to know, and they think the government should do an assessment of how effective CCTV cameras are actually at curbing and cutting crime. They're not convinced that it does perform that basic function. For example, they want to, on the national DNA database, they're also very excited about that. They want to see a recent European judgment saying that anyone who's profiles were put on that database after being arrested but were then subsequently not convicted should be taken off, as should other people who volunteer. And they're also rightfully perhaps concerned about local authority use of what's known as the Reaper surveillance powers, which have been quite highly publicised in the last couple of years, cases of surveillance operations being mounted to catch fly tippers, litterers, people who, whether or not to check, they're actually living in the postcode they say they do when applying for a school place, that kind of thing. And they do question quite strongly whether local authorities should continue to have these powers and say they should only really be used for serious crime investigations.
How's the government likely to respond to this?
Well, in some respects, apart from the language, many of the things they put forward, the government has moving on in a way. The government said it would take off. It's going to implement the European judgment on the DNA database. It's already agreed that local authorities have probably been acting inappropriately in using their covert surveillance powers in that way. What the report, unfortunately, is silent on is on two very controversial government proposals about to come up down the track. One for a super database to track everyone's traffic of the use of mobile phones, texts, use of the internet. And a second one from Jack Straw to allow, lower the barriers to widespread sharing of personal data across the public sector. And unfortunately, the report is silent on both those proposals.
Alan Travis. Taking on the likes of Jeffrey Sachs, Bono and Bob Geldof, Dambisa Moyo argues in her new book that foreign aid for Africa is not only ineffective, but downright harmful. The Zambian-born economist, who's worked for the World Bank and Goldman Sachs, spoke to The Guardian's Mark Tran after giving a talk at Chatham House in London under the provocative title The Credit Crisis: The Best Thing That Could Happen for Africa's Development.
Yes, I mean, I'm looking at that from a very long-term perspective. I believe it's a great opportunity for African governments to start to innovate away from just relying on aid towards other types of development financing.
And what is wrong with aid? I mean, you don't believe in aid per se. It's not a question of whether it's effective or not, but you think aid is a bad thing.
Yes, I think ultimately giving somebody something for nothing in return is at any time, in any place, pretty much a bad thing. Now, this is not to say that there aren't some good aid projects that have worked on the ground, but it's just to say that broadly, if the goal is to increase growth and reduce poverty, aid has not been able to do that.
Well, despite the $1 trillion in past 50 years or
correct,
so?
Correct. It's been $1 trillion of aid, which is largely the government-to-government flows over the past 60 years just to Africa, and it has consistently not delivered.
And is one of the keys the fact that aid makes African governments not responsible to their own people but to the donors?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the other there's a whole host of reasons. I mean, one of them is the issue of corruption. There's the issue of aid dependency. The issue of debt of Dutch disease, where governments receiving all this money basically kills off the export sector. But the one that you've also touched upon is this issue of disenfranchising the domestic citizenry, because governments basically become beholden to the international donors, and they don't really care and are not accountable to what the citizens have to say.
Now, what you say goes very much against what people like Bono, even Gordon Brown, argue, which is more aid, or at least to keep up present levels of aid despite the economic crisis.
Yeah, I think that's it's quite disappointing, actually, because at the end of the day, I think this is an opportunity to innovate. We know that countries that have do more trade, countries that are more open for FDI, foreign direct investment, countries that go to the bond markets have been much more successful than countries that simply rely on aid. And therefore, to push more aid onto Africa seems to me to be wrong policy.
But is it realistic in this climate to expect private capital to go to projects in health, education, infrastructure?
I'm not saying that my proposition is easy. Certainly there are going to be challenges to African budgets, as there will be for budgets all around the world. What I'm saying is that African governments should not be wed or only focused on traditional markets of raising capital. They should start looking to other places around the world that, even after in this post-crisis or in this crisis scenario, are still sitting on a lot of money. Places like China, places like the Middle East. There might be scope. In fact, I believe there's scope for these African governments to really focus on building alliances that can help fuel economic growth over the longer term.
Do you think Africa should give up on the West, and specifically the Doha round, which was supposed to bring down trade barriers to African countries?
At the end of the day, Africa's goal should be to be a part of the global community as an equal partner. This cannot be done without a role for the West and for the emerging countries broadly around the world. However, that being said, I do think it is quite a waste of resources for African governments to continue to spend time and money trying to have the WTO rules overhauled and overturned, because at the end of the day, the trading system is actually deliberately the way it is. Like the emerging countries are up against the developed countries that have incentives to keep the system as it is. My book is really serving as a catalyst, I would hope, to get more African governments to start to focus on this new agenda, as opposed to continue to rely on an aid-dependent model.
Dambisa Moyo, whose book, Dead Aid, Why Aid Is Not Working and How There Is Another Way for Africa, is published by Allen Lane. For the second year running, the American writer James Patterson is the UK's most borrowed author from libraries. His books were taken out more than 1.5 million times between July 2007 and June 2008. Well, I'm ashamed to say that I'm not familiar with his work, as I confessed to The Guardian's arts correspondent, Mark Brown.
John, that's because you're reading Ulysses and, all the works of James Joyce, isn't it? But you should be reading James Patterson, who is one of the most popular writers in the world. I mean, he's not really a writer, he's more a sort of industry or factory, because he employs other writers, and he quite often has, it's James Patterson and another person, and he just churns out these books. So he's got a series of cop books, the Alex Cross series of sort of cop souls, brutal serial killings and slayings. Then you've got the Women's Murder Club, which is a group of four women who meet over Mexican food and try and solve murders. Then you've kind of got these young adult books about this group of kids who are part human and part bird.
And as you say, he is very prolific. And actually, the previous holders of this accolade have also been very prolific.
Oh, that's right. Jacqueline Wilson for 4 years, and Catherine Cookson for about 18 years before that. And I mean, that's the reason they're number one, because they turn out so many books. People like them, and also people know what they're going to get.
Now, these statistics were published today by a body called Public Lending Right. What do they do?
Basically, they were set up 30 years ago to make sure that all authors who have their works borrowed in libraries get paid. And the going rate, I think, at the moment is something like 5.98 pence.
And what
so,
are they?
So if you think, Patterson, 1.5 million of his books were borrowed last year. Does that mean he gets 1.5 million times 5.98 pence? The answer is no.
Because he's American.
He doesn't get anything. Yeah,
exactly. But he's not short of a few bob.
No, he got $50 million in 1 year, according to Forbes magazine.
Well, that's all right then. What do they say was the most popular book from Britain's libraries?
Two guesses.
Harry Potter?
Exactly. It's Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows was number one. And that was followed by Kate Morton and The House at Riverton, which is number two. It's quite interesting, in the top 10, five of the top 10 books were on Richard and Judy's book club reads. So it shows the significance of getting on the Richard and Judy list.
What does it tell us about the state, the health of Britain's libraries?
Well, I think it does prove that there is a real appetite for A, reading, and B, libraries. And, you know, sometimes you hear these terrible stories about council wanting to cut funding to libraries and cut hours to libraries. And this just shows that people really don't want that to happen. Especially now in, you know, recessionary times. People do want to read. So let them read for free. Let them go to libraries.
Mark Brown. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.